Talking with Edwin Knowles, better known as Eddie, who has been in the druggist profession in Alliance or pharmacy for most of his professional active life. He's a native of Alliance and probably could discourse a lot on the background and anecdotes, history of Alliance, but we want to talk about drugstores and pharmacy, the way this has changed, and maybe some of the experiences he has had, some of the individuals he remembers, some of the drugstores. Now let's start off, let's locate first, where did you grow up? Where were you born in the location-wise in Alliance, Ed?
I was born at a little house near Harrison and Union. Of course, Harrison Street wasn't put through in those days. That was April 20th, 1905. And the circus grounds were directly behind our home at that particular time. Of course, I didn't remember those. My sister did. And, of course, I've been in Alliance all my life, with the exception of a few years out of Alliance for college and Cleveland and a little time spent in Arkansas. But outside of that, I've been...
Now, you started off at college. You went to Mount, and then you transferred to Ohio State. Is that right?
That's right. That's right.
And you went right on to the pharmacy school there.
That's right. That's right.
Then, then professionally, where did you come back? You started, what, in the 20s?
I graduated from Ohio State in January 23. I became a licensed pharmacist in April, and I started with Burgett Noble. Of course, I had that's where I started when I was a freshman in high school. I started in the drugstore, working for Burgett Noble. And in those days, of course, we did everything. And by that I mean that there were a lot of concoctions that were mixed up in the drugstore, which today you receive already made, and like making spirits of camphor and camphorated oil and spirits of nitre, which was made from nitroglycerin and alcohol.
I recall as a boy growing up in a small town when the doctor physician came out, he was also the druggist in that town, but he would mix up powders and he gave them in little paper capsules. Now, did you do that, or had the pill arrived, the pre-prepared drugs?
Well, when I first started working in the drugstore, of course, the pharmacist would mix up the powder and then put them on powder papers, and then we would fold the powder papers. Many, many powders were made in those days, mm-hmm. and many mixtures were made in those days. But, of course, we weren't allowed to mix anything until we had a pharmacy license, that is, on a prescription. But today it's entirely different. In fact, everything is made up.
That is made by a pharmacy house,
that's
a druggist.
Right. With the exception of some preparations like penicillins and antibiotics, where you add water to them, and from that instant on, they start deteriorating. But up to that time, if they're not mixed with a fluid, they don't deteriorate. Of course, they have a shelf life on them, which is marked right on the carton.
Now, when you start, I know I talked to you earlier on one occasion, and you mentioned that when, I suppose it wasn't a patent medicine man, but when an individual had some sort of a cure-all remedy would come in, people would just flock to buy this. The drugstore would stock it, and we don't have anything like that today. Hadacol is the last thing I can think of in the 50s, I guess, but I think you were referring in earlier years there were products like that.
Well, back in the 20s and 30s, even in the 30s, there were different tonics where they would send in a promotion man from a company, and probably in a single day he may sell 150 bottles of that preparation. He talked to everybody who came in the store, and of course everybody was interested in feeling better, and for a dollar and a half or two, that meant a considerable volume of business. Of course, today you have to be very careful. Of course, in those days, you say this is almost a cure-all for everything.
Everything, yes.
But today you can't do that. The government doesn't allow you to say hardly anything. And it's different.
Did you find in those days that many people And of course, we know that the background, education-wise, has increased so much. Many people come in with very limited education, almost regarded the druggist as a doctor, didn't they? And I imagine today there are people even who want you to prescribe for them to shortcut the fee for a doctor, but wasn't it more prevalent in those days? The pharmacist was regarded as a dispenser of cure-alls?
Well, probably more so in earlier times than it is now. But even today, we have many people who come in with a common cold or want to feel better and need a tonic or want your advice on vitamins, which you can give. And, of course, I don't care to do it. Actually, I don't care to do it because I think that's the physician's job. And if we find out that in questioning a person that they have a problem, we would say, well, you should see your family physician, because mm-hmm. many times some things are more serious than they seem. Mm-hmm. And the best route is to have them contact their family doctor.
Do you recall in when you were growing up and in your first experience here 50 years ago, there were any so-called patent medicine men? I remember in the little vicinity where I grew up, there was an old gentleman. He had a Lincoln hat, stovepipe hat, and he got the empty bottles from all the women in the neighborhood and would wash them, and then he made his concoctions, and he had a horse and buggy, and later a Model T, went around and sold these. Did you run into any of this? Were there any self-styled?
Well, actually, my first job where I earned any money that I can recall was working for an Indian. an Indian medicine show came to town, and I helped set his teepee up and worked for him all day long. And for that, I received 27 cents and a free ticket to the medicine show. And I can still remember that. They had these concoctions they recommend for everything from tapeworm to calluses and would cure all for everything. In those days, they could say it was a cure all for even consumption and headaches and upset stomach and ulcers and this and that. And of course, during the medicine show, of course, they would have a little act where the Indian would probably be ready to scalp the gal, and then the hero would come in and save the day. Right after the show, or during the show, they would give their pitch on the medication, and I still remember almost a sea of dollar bills being held up.
Where was this? Where was this held? Do you recall?
It was actually held right across the street from where we live. Union Avenue. Mm-hmm. There was a big field over there, and that's where it was. Mm-hmm.
Now, I noticed today many people are getting back to the land, getting back to nature, the whole earth catalog. Many people feel that many of these newer drugs and antibiotics have side effects, which maybe not be apparent right at the start, but they increase, accumulate. And some people are talking about going back to nature's remedies through the old herbals. And I suppose you've noticed advertisements for this, too, you know, nature's way.
Well, that's well and good, because I remember when I was a small boy, we had many herbs in the back in our garden, and like peppermint tea and catnip and a few others. And if anything, we had any difficulty, we would get a tea mm-hmm. or something like that, or home remedies, rubbing with camphor oil and goose grease for congestion on the chest and a lot of those things. Well, it's well and good, but they could replace the antibiotics and the penicillin and a few other cure-alls that we have today. Admittedly, they have many, many side effects, mm-hmm. but sometimes the cure is almost worse than the disease.
Yeah, this is true.
But today we are saving many lives, which we lost before.
Right. This is true.
And you look at old families, and you find that many of the younger people in the family died because of lack of medication.
Yes.
And, but it's a different ball game today. And, of course, nature has many good products if they're used properly mm-hmm. and with a certain amount of reserve. But when it gets to a critical point, then we have to take into account the modern day medication. No doubt they have side effects.
Yes, in regard to that, how would you say the curriculum has changed? You were a freshman in pharmacy school in the 20s. If you were a freshman going to Ohio State Pharmacy School and this fall, what could you say about, what would you think would be the biggest difference in the type of study?
Well, when I was in pharmacy school, I think we were taught the basics of pharmacy, like, materia medica, and toxicology, and bacteriology, and the basics in chemistry, elementary and organic and inorganic, and quantitative and qualitative chemistry. So if we went into a manufacturing facility, we could utilize those skills. But today, when you go into a pharmacy school, you can be expected to take 5 to 6 years to get out of pharmacy school. And I sometimes wonder whether it's worth it, because you go into a drugstore today, the pharmacist is kept so busy filling prescriptions, he has nothing, he can't spend any time on anything else. Of course, if you go into a manufacturing facility, your education stands in well stead.
Mm-hmm.
Because you learn so many sophisticated processes, even getting into laser beams and things like that, which they never even thought of in the day when I was in school. But we had the basics, and we knew how to make mixtures, and we knew incompatibilities. And but today it's very sophisticated. Very sophisticated.
Now, when you first started, you started Burgett & Noble, they did, of course, the pharmacy, the prescriptions. How much additional was there, for example, comic books and boxes of candy and perfume and all of these other items that a drugstore contains? If you took all of that, or say you took just the prescription, the pharmacy part, 3/4 of the drugstore would disappear today. When did this happen, this growth like this?
Well, in the early days of pharmacy, or druggists, as they were called in those days, of course they had prescriptions, they sold soaps. They were probably the sole source of cosmetics, and they sold many, many different types of skin soaps. And of course they sold some gift items, and stationery, and cameras, possibly, and that probably made up the bulk of the business. The prescription business may have been about 15 to 20% of the business.
Mm-hmm.
But I would say today, prescription business accounts for possibly even up to a third, and in some cases a half, of the business. It seems to be that there's more prescriptions being written today, and there's a reason for that, because in the old days, of course, many doctors had practically a drugstore in their office, and they dispensed many drug items, pharmaceuticals, from their office. That was the established custom. Or if they called on a patient, they gave the patient enough medication to get over what they had. But today, with so many new antibiotics and expensive ones, doctors can't afford to do those things. And so they write prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say there's more prescription business today, pro rata, for the amount of population, than there was before.
Well, you know, to just a casual observer walking in, you'd think it'd be the other way. You see all these other items, and you think this accounts for the volume of business. So this is an interesting insight into that.
Well, of course, many drugstores today are getting into sundry items and things that actually some hardware items, and some stay out of it completely. Of course, today we sell probably a lot more candy and cigar. Well, we used to sell a lot of cigars. We sell more candy today, and gum and mints, and cosmetic items, and of course, aspirin tablets are common cure for almost everything. And there's a lot of things we sell today, and knickknacks that bring in a few extra pennies, and so they capitalize on it. But everybody and his brother is in on the act.
Yeah.
Even supermarkets and grocery stores sell a lot of health and beauty items.
That's
we
right.
Sell health and beauty items.
Yes.
Which they didn't before. Before drugstores handled those exclusively.
Yes. One thing has always intrigued me, and this is sort of the standard joke or reference, the doctor writing a prescription and wondering how the druggist could read. There are all sorts of stories about the prescription being lost and someone finding it and interpreting it in a completely different way. Is this true? As a general rule, are doctors atrocious writers, or is this just one of the stories that's grown up?
No, that's true. Doctors are atrocious writers, and I think the reason for that is because many have become so busy, they have to write fast. Of course, in the first place, some never did know how to write.
Yes.
And some are very fine writers, very fine. And, of course, you become accustomed to a doctor's handwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And the way I put it, there's a way to read a prescription. You look at it once and decipher what it is, but you never look at it the second time because you won't be able to decipher it in the second round.
Mm-hmm.
If there's any doubt about it, then we call the doctor's office and find out what the medication was that was prescribed. But that happens very, very little. And because we cannot be in doubt about something, about the dosage or the directions or any part of the prescription. We just can't afford to make any mistakes.
Yes. What do you do if someone is saying, I flew into Akron, Canton, I'm here on business, this is a prescription from my physician in Phoenix, Arizona. How do you, obviously, if it's from Dr. King or Dr. Noble here, you don't have any question, or you could check if you do, but what do you do in a situation like this?
Well, you have to take the situation into account, because if someone is in dire need of something, a sugar pill or a heart pill or something like that, you are more or less obligated to help them out on it.
Mm-hmm.
If they have a prescription from another state and you think it's a bona fide prescription, it's not a forgery, especially on narcotic.
Yes.
We're very careful on narcotics. We fill it because we are under instruction from the state pharmacy board to do those things. And if someone comes in the store and has forgotten their prescription and they live probably miles away and they need a prescription which is a necessity to maintain their life, like something for diabetes or heart or nitroglycerin, we give them enough to hold them over until they get back back home. That's just no more than right.
Now you have, when we started the interview, you had an ancient looking tome here that's scarred and beaten with age, and there are prescriptions in there that date back to, I think you said, the 1880s, right, from this area here. You want to explain the nature of that and what the purpose of that book was?
Well, in those days, they kept prescriptions in a book. They weren't in a file. Of course, today we are have updated those things to prescription files, now prescription drawers, where they're numerical. We don't have a file on each individual, but that's the way they did it in those days, and they probably had more time to probably paste those in a book and could refer to them by dates. Because today, time is real money.
Yes.
Time is real money as far as a pharmacist is concerned. I mean, as far as paying a pharmacist. For many years, if I may say, pharmacists actually starved. I don't know of any millionaire pharmacists. I don't know of any very wealthy pharmacists.
Unless they developed an elixir or tonic that they sold, Eddie.
That's right. Or invested in real estate where they made a lot of money.
Yeah.
Or they got a lucky break. Or they inherited a lot of money. We have one in town here now who doesn't have to practice because he inherited a lot of money.
Yes.
And, but First, looking back, we used to open the store at 7 o'clock in the morning and close at midnight. And we worked long hours, we worked holidays, we were open holidays, Sundays, and a druggist hours, we'll call them druggists because that's what they called them in those days. Their hours were long and hard. Actually, in some respects, I felt that I didn't have the opportunity to see my family grow up because I was away so much. I spent so many hours around the drugstore, but today it's entirely different. You put in so many hours, the hours are staggered, and you can relive.
Now, you started here with Burgett and Noble. I just made a note here that there was a Cassidy drugstore at that time, and I noticed in the 1920s. That was a Rexall store. And then I don't notice much until I get down to about 1940, and then I think Gray Drugs came in, which is a chain at that time. Were there any others comparable to this, like the Rexall, that you recall?
Well, no, there were, McKesson and Robbins came in with a line of merchandise, which they sold to all drugstores. A Rexall drugstore was a franchise agency for the United Drug Company of Boston. And they sold Rexall products, and that was the Cassidy Drugging Alliance. Well, that went out of existence in about 1934, and then unfortunately, I purchased Cassidy Drug from. I was in there for the bank for about a year, and then the bank sold it to me, and then we had to move, and into a smaller location. Didn't work out, and I sold out to Mr. England. Then I went back with Turner Drug. Of course, I had done some work temporarily for Turner starting about 1930 or 31, and then I went with them in 32. Of course, in 1928, right after I got out of college, after I received my pharmacy license, I was with Marshall Drug in Cleveland for a year. And this is a funny... It was a funny situation. I found out about a year after I was with them that the general manager was receiving $20 more per week than I was, so I didn't think it was worth my while to stick around.
Right.
So I just put in a year with them.
Uh-huh.
And then after I sold out to England, why I went back to Turner, and then at the beginning of World War II, Harry Blythe induced me to come over to Goodyear Aircraft, so I was with them for the duration of the war.
Mm-hmm. And then you've been with Turner.
And I came back with Turner, and I went to the Mount Union store.
Mm-hmm.
Incidentally, when I came back, they had four stores, and Milt Turner was running the operation then. He asked me which store I wanted, so I thought, well, I would take the Mount Union store. That had the smallest volume, and that was about as far away from Turner's as I could get.
Yeah.
With all due respect.
Yes.
With all due respect. But as it turned out, the Mount Union store became the finest store, yeah. The largest volume, and a very good business corner.
It has.
And then, of course, you know what happened. Turner sold out to Schumann Drug.
Yes.
I've been with Schumann's, and I've been trying to retire, but it's difficult.
You're too young to retire, Eddie. I remember when I was a student in college going over and to the corner where Turner Schumann now is. And in those days, you went up four or five steps, as I recall, and went into the building. And Ray Ault had Ault's Pharmacy there. And it was more, as I remember, the old-style pharmacy. He hadn't gotten into other goods as much. And there was a confectionery chair. I mean, this type of the wire, the old-style chair and table. And he had gone, I believe, to Sile College, Sile School of Pharmacy. And I came from down near there and had known one of the professors, and so he encouraged me to stop in. He liked to reminisce about old Professor Hawkins down there and some of the people that he knew. And he was quite a philosopher, along with, and apparently had a little more time. Time was a little freer in those days, and I remember stopping in and spending an hour or so talking with him.
Well, in the older days, of course, pharmacies, of course, started out with without soda fountains.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the way the Cassidy drug was. But Burger Knowles came into town, they put a soda fountain in their store. I think Corner Drug on the corner of Arson Main had a soda fountain. And incidentally, on Main Street at that particular time, there were about 13 drug stores.
Is that right?
And, but then the trend was eventually and that a drugstore could do better without a soda fountain, which became a liability because, you know, the amount of Dairy Queens and a lot of other places that started out, the competition became severe and it was a lost leader.
And yet, whenever Schumann's took over there and took that out, I don't know how many people, now maybe business-wise it wouldn't amount to that much, but I know so many, many people complained about this, or at least I seem to hear that. They seem to like that and appreciate it.
Well, that's true, because you come in there and reminisce with other people, sit down and relax a little bit. It was an asset, I think, to the stores. But what so many people didn't realize that at that time, that soda fountain was costing us $30 a day to operate. We were running in the hole that much.
Oh, yeah.
And today, you can't afford luxuries like that.
That's true.
So there wasn't any, there weren't two ways about it at all. So you had to get rid of it.
Well, this is what we look back and say, those were the good old days, you know, and you had that type of thing. Can you remember during the course of your association experience here, were there any druggists who were unique or we would say sort of characters or had anything distinguishing? Is there anything that comes to mind or any drugstore that specialized or had something unusual in the way of location or,
Well, when I look back over a period of years, I've always thought that, and I am one of them myself, and I can probably put myself in that lot. But I always felt that druggists were odd characters. They had they were set in their ways, and they had certain philosophies, and which probably didn't amount to much. And of course, some knew all the answers, which later led to their demise.
Mm-hmm.
But probably something that went toward that or made them that way is because they spent, I don't know why, whether it had any effect on them or not, but they spent so many hours working and away from their families.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I wouldn't say that exactly of the old Burger Noble regime because they had their hours staggered and that was worked out all right. At one particular time, when we had so many drugstores in Alliance, we all got together and decided that we shouldn't all stay open on Sundays. So one drugstore would stay open on Sunday, the other would have a sign in their window saying, so-and-so is open on this Sunday, and the person would know where to go.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant probably you were open one every 15 or 18 Sundays.
Yeah.
And that helped out
a
lot.
That would be a big help.
But then we had competition come in town, a big chain, and they wouldn't go along with it, so everybody opened up.
Well, I, of course, would take exception. I think you've been a very genial and cooperative and a druggist, and many people like and respect you, and this is, I think, sure one of the reasons that that location there on Union and State prospered the way it did, Eddie. I'm sure of that. I noticed in looking over here there are some names like Diver Drug, Vale Drug, Olinger Drug, Smith's Incorporated, Brown's Cut Rate, Central Drug. Now this is just since, you know, in the last 50 years or so. Now, those names suggest anything?
Well, yeah, Diver Drug, of course, Turner's bought out many drugstores like Ray Alt and Mount Union. They bought out the Diver drugstores. They bought out Vale's drugstore when that was closed up. They bought out Bandy Drug in Sebring when that was closed. And then, of course, Brown's Cut Rate was right next to Sears there on the alley. And, of course, they created a furor. But by the same token, when Berger Nobles came into town in about 1914-15, they advertised as the cut rate drugstore.
Mm-hmm.
And the cut rate was from a dollar down to 89 cents, 50 cents down to 44, and 25 to 23. Well, that wouldn't hold even water today.
No, I'll say not.
A lot of the other druggists were upset about the thing because they were all getting full prices. But I think the success of this Berger Noble outfit was that they were very friendly and they seemed to go along, and they became very successful. And of course, from then on, everybody had to more or less mm-hmm. fight for the business they got.
Yes.
That's the way it is today anyway, because this is no place for somebody that's a Mr. Milquetoast in the business.
That's right. That's for sure. Yeah. And there, of course, as in so many other businesses, the little corner store, the pop and mom type, have gone. It's a big chain, and if you can't compete with that, you're swallowed up with that.
Well, the big chain has everything cut and dry. They have price. They have merchandise. They have good display. They have good advertising. All in all, everything is organized.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is organized, right down the line, because one chain has to compete with the other. And if you miss a bet on something, why, someone else picks it up and you lose. And today, that they really have to be on their toes. All these chains, just like discount stores. My brother told me on the West Coast. One opens up, one closes up. One opens up, one closes up.
Mm-hmm.
That's how severe competition is today. And of course, as I understand it, competition is so tough even in the department store business. That two large, very large outfits in the department store business are way in debt that they'll never get out.
I suppose.
But, it probably was a different life in the earlier days, but I think being in the drug business today, being a pharmacist, it's a lot nicer, a lot easier. You have to be on your toes when you're there.
Well, of course, you know, this goes back to the good old days, but again, a personal experience. I grew up in a small town, and one summer, the druggist, I was in high school, the doctor, the physician, was the druggist. He had a drugstore across from his house and dispensed. And he was getting up in years, and he liked roses. He was a rose fancier, and he said, I'd have to have someone mind the drugstore. He had no other help. He was the only person, he and his wife had died. So he got me to, and he said, no, you just can't sit here, so I want you to dust all of these shelves. And he had patent medicines that went back to the turn of the century, never sold. But in addition, he had these large glass jars with the Latin name and, etched. Now, you have a fine collection of those.
I do, yeah. I have a couple hundred of them, and of course I have given some to the children, and even Dr. Pappenhagen I gave maybe half mm-hmm. a dozen to at one time. I didn't think they were worth anything, but now I find they're worth about $50 a piece.
Yeah. Now, those were used. They made quite a... I suppose they were eye-catching when you used to walk in. They awed many people to see this and to see the Latin name and then some sort of a compound or mixture chemical in it. Now, you talked about materia medica. Is that connected with this?
I would say materia medica is the study of the various preparations, herbs and chemicals and things like that on the human body and how it acts on the human body.
Mm-hmm.
Doctors have to go through courses on that too. But there was a reason for these old bottles in those days, because they had to have something to hold the herbs. There were so many herbs and chemicals they used. And practically everything was mixed. They had no modern pharmaceuticals at all. Penicillin, antibiotics, they never heard those words. And if you had pneumonia back in the 20s, you had no cure for it.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be what they call empirical. That's based on experience,
yes,
on how to treat it.
And so these jars serve the purpose of holding chemicals or the herbs?
Chemicals and herbs. and anything they need, they use in the mixing of prescriptions.
Mm-hmm.
And in those days, they had to mix many things, as you see in that old book.
Yes, yes.
They didn't come in with a prescription for penicillin tablets where you counted out so many and wrote it up, and cost the patient a lot of money. And of course, in those days, probably a prescription might have been filled for 50 or 75 cents.
Seems hard to believe today.
Yeah. Of course, wages weren't.
No, this is true.
Weren't there either.
This is true.
And I,
Now, I understand some, in the legal practice, they're going to require lawyers to take every so many years a refresher course to keep up with some developments. Is there something similar to this for pharmacists today, that they'll have to go back periodically?
Well, starting with the pharmacy license, once you received your license, that was good for life. And all you need to do is make application, and they would send you a new license about every 3 years. And you send a $5 fee in. Of course, nowadays you send in $25, and in addition to that, in order to receive a license, you have to you have to have 15 hours of work, of study work, 15 hours of credit every year in order to maintain your pharmacy license. But that didn't go into effect until about 4 years ago, three years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I just received my new license, and of course, I only had 30 hours on this time, but next time I will have 45. Which I hope I don't have to meet.
How do you meet that now? What do you do?
Well, you take it by correspondence. They give you literature to read, and then they have a quiz on it. They send you a list of questions, and then you answer these questions, and then you pass it.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it seems that nobody hardly flunks it, but they can tell from your answers what work you've done on it, and then of course they have computer codes which identify any work you might take with various sources, and then you present these to the pharmacy commission when you apply for a new license, and then they usually accept that.
Mm-hmm.
Evidently they did in my case.
Mm-hmm.
So I have sufficient hours. Now I'm starting on my next 45 hours, so
mm-hmm.
I have that
mm-hmm.
when my license comes up in 3 years. Well, fact is, I have to apply every year. Now, next year I will get my license, but on the third year I have to present 45 hours.
Certification that you have completed that.
That's right.
Well, now, to go back to the time you were starting back in the 20s there, you must have known some older druggists, as you call them at that time. What would their preparation have been, pharmacy-wise? Would they have?
Well, years ago, of course, you spoke of Ray Ault and probably Bert Noble and the Cassidys and Cortner and the Divers and Vail. Their preparation was probably consisted of about 2 years in college, in pharmacy college. And then they were awarded a pharmacy certificate to practice pharmacy. But then, in the early 20s, around 1920, they changed that to 4 years,
mm-hmm.
which I had to go under.
Yes.
And now it's up to 5 and 6 years, according to what kind of degree you want. But the minimum would be 5 years.
Hmm. Of course, as you've indicated, with the tremendous breakthrough on these synthetics, antibiotics, all this type of miracle or wonder drug, I suppose it demands much more, doesn't it?
Well, of course, these companies give a resume every time they bring out a new product, the physiological properties and the directions and what they are for and what to expect and the side effects. Of course, the government requires a considerable amount of explanation on all products, and it has to accompany every bottle that's put out. But we can get that literature. I mean, that literature comes with every prayer operation that comes in, and we can read that literature. But it's not too tough to keep up with most of them. Of course, they're all broken down into probably antibiotics or penicillin-type preparations against gram-negative or gram-positive organisms. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the basics in chemistry and your materia medica and your foundation, it's not too difficult a job mm-hmm. to
keep up with that.
Keep up with those things.
I noticed in looking back in 1920 in the diver drugs, there was a William Diver and a Nettie, and I didn't know whether she was a pharmacist, whether she practiced. I was just interested with women's lib, of course, and with women getting into. Oh, we had a picture in the paper, this first of the week of a young girl being ordained at the Christian church mm-hmm. over the weekend. And there's resistance in some churches, Episcopal, I guess. What about women in pharmacy?
Well, I remember when I was in pharmacy school, there weren't many women. Of course, today I think there's a lot more. But as I remember, the senior Bill Diver was a pharmacist. And I don't recall if his son, Bill, I knew his son, Bill. I don't recall a Nettie. Nettie must have been a senior Bill's wife.
She could just have been an owner of the store and not a practitioner.
But in those days, pharmacists could leave the store and go home to dinner and take 2 or 3 hours possibly and be away from the store. And then someone bring in a prescription and say, well, I'll fill this in 2 or 3 hours. And you didn't have to have a registered pharmacist at the store all the time. But now, you have to have a registered pharmacist there every minute.
Oh, mm-hmm.
You cannot have the door open unless you have a registered pharmacist in the store.
Mm-hmm.
It has to be covered, otherwise you get fined. And, of course, today, I remember years ago, we never heard of a pharmacy inspector. Never. Unless someone violated a law. Real bad, but today the pharmacy inspector makes periodic inspections mm-hmm. of your pharmacy department. And also he checks on doctors, and if they have a unusual amount of narcotic prescriptions in certain places or from a certain doctor or drugstores for filling a lot of narcotics, then they investigate.
Mm-hmm.
And they internal narcotic division they keep a close check on those things, and if you have violated the law, they come in with a fine-tooth comb, and they'll spend a week with probably one or two men going over all your records, and if you violate any law, then you're up against it.
Yes.
But they know who it is.
Mm-hmm. Well, in the course of your experience here, you said there were a great many drugstores on Main Street at one time. They were saying the 20s or 30s. I think you said there were a dozen, something like that, maybe. Lying
I think
on Main
there were 13.
Street. 13.
13 one time. Well, that's logical because drugstores were handling all health preparations. There weren't any in any grocery stores in those days. Drugstores sold a lot of soaps, and they had the market cornered, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a good demand, and then on top of that, they furnished doctors with a lot of their medication, which doctors receive now from physician supply houses.
Mm-hmm.
And they all seemed to be getting along financially.
Mm-hmm.
They weren't setting the world on fire. But
some of those old prescriptions, I noticed about 2-3 years ago, I think the New York Times had a feature story that Lydia Pinkham's went out of business. And the company, the family, had controlled that, and they never did give up the secret of the ingredients and federal Pure Food got after them, and they listed some, but there were still, they had a mystique about this. And, of course, the assumption with many people is that most of these tonics and elixirs contained 90% alcohol and maybe some herbs.